Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. Today, ISF CEO Steve Durbin is in conversation with Viviane Reding, the former first vice president of the European Commission, who was responsible for justice, industry, telecommunications, research in technology, education, culture, and sports. She and Steve discuss the ramifications of GDPR, cybercrime, and what kind of governance in cyberspace is possible moving into the future.
Viviane, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me on this ISF podcast. You spoke recently at our Digital 2021 Congress, and you talked about a whole range of different issues related to privacy, to technology, the way in which the world is changing. I wanted to talk to you specifically about GDPR. I think one of the things I noticed when you were talking at our Congress was you referred to it as my GDPR. So it was something that you'd been obviously very intimately involved with. Put it into context for us. Why is GDPR, why is the issue of privacy so very important?
Well, that comes out of history. You see, Europe has been created at the end of the Second World War, people coming out of war, out of dictatorships. And then we had the enlargement to the Eastern countries coming out of communist dictatorships. So the heaviness of the spying of governments on individuals is a horror story for our citizens. So it all started there. You have to protect the citizens against somebody from outside, be it the government or somebody else, to be heavy on their privacy. The personal data belong to the person and not to a company and not to a state. And there have to be very clear rules so that a person can handle with confidence these data to a company or to the state.
And it took some years to get all of that through. I think 2018 was when actually it became in effect the regulation. The ISF was doing a lot of work in terms of preparing its members for GDPR. And I remember talking a lot with members in the United States, trying to explain the differences between the European perspective on GDPR and on privacy and that of the American view. How much of that has changed, do you think, that European versus American view in the last 3 years since we've had GDPR?
I think it hasn't changed because the starting point is very difficult. The American rules are based on security, on law enforcement, and the citizen comes second, whereas the European rules are based on the citizen and his rights. And then we have to find ways in order to have law enforcement working nevertheless. So the starting point is quite different. And also the right of the individual, the fact that an individual can sue when his or her privacy has been endangered by a state or by a company is also a very important element. But this is explained out of the war times or out of the dictatorship from the right or from the left, which citizens have been suffering under.
And one of the arguments that was always put to me and still is today is that, particularly when we look at technology, so very many of the large technology companies are American, of course. And so there is this challenge that they face about handling data and with regulation. How do you think we can resolve that issue? Because there's a whole range of different things that are going on at the moment with, you know, Amazon being fined and Google and so on. Is there a way through, you think, that we can find?
Yes, there is a way through. First, the companies have to abide to the law. And not only do it in a superficial way, hoping that nobody cares for it. So, for instance, the agreement of a citizen so that you or a company can utilize his or her private data must be a real agreement and not a tick the box only. And it is also clear that citizens, if they agree that you utilize their data, well, let them freely agree and utilize it, but don't hide behind superficial ways of agreeing and misuse the data.
So what would your advice be then to, say, a multinational? So we've got people listening to this podcast who are responsible for privacy within their organizations, for instance. What sort of advice would you give them if they're responsible for privacy across, say, a multinational organization?
If you are in Europe and you work in Europe, you utilize the data of citizens of any nationality in Europe, just cling to the rules. It is easy. I have seen that some big multinational companies invested a lot of fighting the rules instead of adapting themselves to the rules. It would have been much cheaper, less fuss, and much more efficient if they would have, from the beginning on, adapted to the rules.
And GDPR was originally, I remember us talking about it, as being a European standard. It very soon became something of the bar that other countries viewed as having been set, didn't it? But there were some exceptions to that. And some countries have taken a little longer. So China in particular has just moved to adopt some of the guidelines that are in GDPR. But what's your view on the latest Chinese regulation and legislation with regard to privacy?
Well, China has a different view on privacy than Europe has. It has a different political system. It's a superpower of the state, something which in Europe is unthinkable. And so their angle of doing things is different normally. And of course, they have copied a lot of the European GDPR, but only for companies, mm-hmm. not for state organizations, which have a complete carve-out. So it's not comparable because the system is not comparable.
So what then, or where then, does the individual stand?
In China?
So a European
the
citizen?
European citizen, well, if the European citizen is aware of its privacy, and people are in theory very aware of privacy. Are they in practice? That is another question. But at any rate, it is in the DNA of European citizens to expect from their government not to spy on them and to abide to the rules. So you could not in Europe have a different modus vivendi than the one we have chosen to do. And for the companies, it's also easier. If you have one rule for the rendering services in the whole of the internal European market, rather than to abide to 27 different rules, it is much easier, most of all for our small companies and for our startups. They have only to make the work once, mm-hmm. and then they can utilize the whole market.
So in a way, GDPR is also supporting the growth of entrepreneurial businesses by setting that overall standard. Is that the way that you would view it?
That is absolutely true. So rules must not be a hampering element. Mm-hmm. They have to allow the freedom of the individual and they have to allow the freedom of the companies to do their job, but in a certain rules-based system. And if everybody obeys to those rules, then they can fly. Imagine a small startup, let's say in my home country, Luxembourg. Now, we have borders all over the place very quickly in another country. And so we don't have a big market. And this small startup, in order to develop, needs to take advantage of the neighboring country's market. Now, if it has each time, if it goes to France, if it goes to Germany, if it goes to Belgium, if it goes to the Netherlands, make a complete new rule system, it will never fly. So the fact that we have one rule for the whole continent is of utmost importance for giving a chance to our startups.
One of the questions that I'm asked by some of our members at the moment relates to the fact that the ISF is a UK-headquartered organisation. Our members are from all around the world, of course, but we're headquartered in the UK. And one of the questions that they ask me is, why is it that the UK potentially is looking at changing some of the regulations around privacy and moving away, in some eyes, from those basic tenets of GDPR? Now, we can debate whether or not we think that to be the case, but let me put a hypothetical question to you. If the UK were to change, how do you think the European Union would react?
Well, the European Union has given an adequacy ruling to the UK, which means that we consider, we as a continent, consider that the way Great Britain handles privacy equal to the way Europe handles privacy. That's normal because UK was member of the European Union and applied GDPR. And now, if UK would divert from this and would eliminate some of the guarantees for citizens given by GDPR, then of course the European Commission has no other solution as to take away the authorization to the UK.
So we would lose adequacy effectively.
Absolutely, yes, yes. And that is not a decision of the governments, that is a decision of the European Commission. The European Commission gives the adequacy. It is now, for instance, negotiating with South Korea in order to give the adequacy. But if it sees that the country to which it has given the adequacy changes the rules and is not adequate anymore to the privacy rules of Europe, then it can also take away the adequacy.
So the message there is to have much more conversation about what might be going on so that we don't get into that sort of situation, presumably.
Well, that is a decision the UK has to take. If the UK thinks that it has to go out of adequacy and then be considered a third country also in the exchange of data with its biggest market outside of the UK, leave the UK do that.
Presumably, though, that isn't the ideal position for, as far as you're concerned, from a GDPR standpoint, because GDPR was put together to try to make life easier, not more difficult, effectively.
Yeah, so it's not our choice, it's the choice of the UK.
We've sort of said that GDPR became the sort of the standard, if you like. Was that always your intention when you were working on putting that together, or did you just have a very sort of European-centric view of it at that time?
I had a European-centered view linked on, of course, our fundamental rights, mostly the Treaty of Lisbon, on which the collaboration between the different member states is based, and the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which is our Bill of Rights. They both state the object of the privacy of the individual. The individual has a right to his own personal data, full stop.
Right.
And so that is constitution. So if you are a political leader, you have to build your regulations on the constitution, and that is what I did.
Right, okay. I remember probably back in 2018, round about when GDPR was coming about, talking to Anne Kavoukian, who was the former Privacy Commissioner in Ontario. And there's a podcast on that if any of our listeners particularly want to go back and listen to what Anne had to say. But one of the things we talked about a lot in that was this notion of privacy by design.
Mm-hmm.
So the regulatory umbrella is there to provide the guidelines, but the way to ensure that we protect it is not simply a compliance-based approach. It's by designing privacy into everything that we do and how we go about doing it. Do you think that GDPR has encouraged organizations down that road, or do you think it is still viewed primarily as a piece of compliance that you have to fit in with?
Intelligent companies who like to have a worldwide impact will propose privacy by design to their customers. Because it is not only an element to please the European authorities, it is also an element to give security and trust to your customer. I think privacy by design will even become more important when we go to the development of AI, because at a certain moment, the insecurity of the consumers will grow. There will be scandals, there will be here and there. And if somebody can offer a product or a service with privacy inbuilt, that will be a good selling argument.
I'm glad you mentioned AI, because that's something I'm keen to talk to you about. Is that an area you think where we are under-regulated, where we need to be doing more?
We are not regulated for the time being, because it is like very often in our world, there are developments first, and there are rules second. It's very rarely that you foresee a development. Well, GDPR has a basis of being capable to be adapted to AI, but we have to make ethical rules for a non-biased AI system. And I do believe that we should do that this time not Europe does it and then the others copy the gold standard more or less. I think that we should do it on the, well, we will advance. We are already very much advanced on this, but we should do it with other parts of the world together. It will be very important, and it will give also a certain security to these brilliant young minds who build AI systems to know what to do and where there is a red line.
And how do you think we should go about doing that?
Europe and the US are already working together on common standards for AI. Europe is rather well advanced because it has already the legal proposals on the table. Well advanced, but still a long way to go before the lawmakers, the governments and the European Parliament will have found an agreement on this. But I think AI could be so intrusive and could be so damaging in one hand, could also be such a gold mine and such a positive impact on the other hand, that the best forces in the world should unite in order to make it a positive development.
You talk there about Europe. You talk about the United States. It strikes me that we're missing somebody in that whole discussion, and that is China, I would suggest, who, from an AI perspective, in terms of development of machine learning, and is doing some very interesting things, is very advanced. How do you think we can effectively bring China to the table or work more efficiently using AI as a means, so that what we aren't doing is allowing perhaps Europe and the US to do their own thing and then ignoring?
It is going to be, I suppose, I look into the future, in some way like GDPR went. You have to have a basic rule, and then you have to say to the others, well, if you want to be in trade relations, if you want to exchange, if you want your companies to come to us and our companies go to you, those are the basic rules of behavior in the future. And that has made GDPR to a world standard. And I suppose that if in the beginning the United States and Europe could agree on a common standard, it will very quickly develop to a world standard too.
One of the other things, of course, that is of concern to security professionals, and I think a lot of people, is the development of AI for cybercrime use rather than anything else. So with anything that you produce, obviously there are good uses and there are not so good uses. And that really does raise the issue of regulation and collaboration. A lot of cybercrime, cybercriminals, are able to hide in certain countries around the world where perhaps some of the regulations, some of the laws are not as stringent as in Europe and other parts. How do you think we can work better to remove what is seen by some as being an encouragement of cybercriminals to set up in certain areas? How can Europeans, how can Americans, how can we in the UK be much more proactive in attacking that element of cybercrime?
For the time being, we do not have the right answer to cybercrime, because cybercriminals very often have a step in advance and rules follow. But there is a quick learning curve, and it is a question of power. If you unite the power, let's say, of the United States and the power of the European Union, you can much better fight cybercrime and fight the states which are hosting the cybercriminality, because that is also the fact. They are somewhere. They are also somewhere in our democratic world. So by having strong rules and giving also to the police and to the secret services the means in order to stop them, that will be the way forward. And then there is also a question of education.
Right.
Because we are entering a completely new world of digital, and our education systems are not adapted. So we educate young people who have not got the basis which they need in order to help this society to go to the right direction. So we have also to put our hands together in ameliorating the education systems and bringing the fight against negative use of digital in the forefront and educate a new generation which is more able to defend itself.
There may be some people listening to this that say, particularly to your point about fighting cybercrime, that that's all well and good. But are we not then perhaps compromising on privacy, on some of those fundamental precepts in GDPR? Because in order to fight cybercrime more efficiently, some might say the state has to have access to more information, has to be able to track it, has to be able to make use of it. Do you see that as being perhaps a challenge?
It is always a challenge to have security on one side and freedom on the other, because in order to secure the security, maybe I have to take a small piece of freedom away. But if it is on a rules-based way, look, GDPR in Europe is a system for the economy and for the individual. But we have a directive on how we treat privacy with police and security forces. So that is a part and gives other possibilities than the GDPR, because there are two interests which are sometimes clashing. Mm-hmm. We cannot have one interest over the other, but we can also not have one interest wiping out the other. So it is a very delicate way of balancing that is going on. We have tried it in Europe, as I said, with having the regulation applying to the whole thing and a directive applying to member states and their security forces, which gives a possibility to fight crime. And I think we should do exactly the same when we tackle AI. The basis is there. You have to adapt it to the developments of the digital world.
Vivian, it's been fascinating talking to you. We could sit here and talk all afternoon, but time's against us. So thank you very much for spending the time explaining some of those issues around GDPR and really, I think, providing a lot of our listeners with some of that additional insight that perhaps they wouldn't have otherwise had. So thank you very much indeed for your time, Vivian Redding.
You are much welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks to this week's guest, Vivian Redding. Next week, we're changing gears a bit. Steve and I will be back to discuss the emerging threats to watch out for in 2022. In the meantime, is there a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find the catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write a short review. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, associate producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.